chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are rest make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. This is George Butler. We've got quite a program going this evening, and we're going to lead off with Elon Musk warning us about AI. You know, they have this this AI that's making all kinds of inroads. And we should warn people. They have free membership, sign up here and sign up there. But it's best to stay away from those types of mechanisms. And your people are being drawn into those things, and it can be dangerous for us in the future. But here's what Elon Musk had to say about the dangers of AI.
Mark my words, AI is far more dangerous than nukes.
I try to convince people to slow down AI, to regulate AI. This was futile. I tried for years.
I'm really quite close to, very close to the cutting edge in AI, and it scares the hell out of me. It's capable of vastly more than almost anyone knows, and the rate of improvement is exponential.
It feels like we are the biological bootloader for AI, effectively. We are building it. And then we're building progressively greater intelligence, and the percentage of intelligence that is not human is increasing. And eventually, we will represent a very small percentage of intelligence.
Freedom consists of the distribution of power and despotism in its concentration. And so I think it's important, if we have this incredible power of AI, that it not be concentrated in the hands of a few and potentially lead to a world that we don't want. All of us already are cyborgs. So you have a machine extension of yourself in the form of your phone and your computer and all your applications. You are already superhuman. But by far, you have more power, more capability than the President of the United States had, you know, 30 years ago. So everyone is already superhuman.
We're rapidly headed towards digital superintelligence that far exceeds any human. I think it's pretty obvious.
I think it's best to take and heed his advice and his warning. Next up is Tucker Carlson and Glenn Greenwald, and they're talking about this recent Pentagon breach of these top secret documents has caused an uproar, and how many people are going to die because those the release or so forth. But anyway, a young 21-year-old National Guardsman who had top secret clearance somehow got hold of these documents. And here's what Tucker Carlson and Glenn Greenwald have to say.
Glenn Greenwald has seen stories like this very, very up close and personal. He's the host of System Update on Rumble. He broke, of course, the most famous leaking story in American history, the story of Ed Snowden. He joins us tonight. Glenn, thanks so much for coming on. I should say... And I'll just be quiet and let you speak, since you know this better than anyone. But we left out a lot of details that are being reported in the Washington Post, the New York Times, et cetera, tonight about the leaker and where this all came from. Because honestly, I don't believe anything. And it's very hard to know what's true. We're all being spun. We're all being lied to. And we just didn't want to repeat the lies. So with that, what do you make of this?
I can't think of an incident, Tucker, that reveals more vividly the real function of our nation's largest media corporations than what just happened here. If you're a real journalist, somebody who's devoted to transparency, shining a light on the most powerful government actors when they lie to the American people and informing the public, you would be celebrating this person who stepped forward and risked his security to show his fellow citizens that the government was lying about this incredibly important war with a nuclear-armed power, that we have actual troops deployed on the ground in Ukraine. There's going to be no diplomatic resolution through at least 2023, that Zelensky is planning on using our weapons to strike deep into Russia, which we were told was would ever happen, risking escalation. He did the job of what journalists claim to do, which is show the public the truth. If you work for the intelligence agencies, you would be furious at this person. You would hate him because he revealed that you just lied. He exposed the truth about what you were doing. What's amazing is the New York Times, the Washington Post, all the people who were at that Pentagon briefing today think the way the CIA and the Pentagon think. They hate this person. It was the New York Times and the Washington Post that did the FBI's work and found the leaker and led the FBI to him. They're demanding that he be punished. They're demanding that the government clamp down and keep things more and more secret. What kind of journalist would ever do that, would want to see a leaker exposed and punished and then demand that the government keep even more secret? But that is what these media corporations are there to do. They love leaks when the CIA and Homeland Security tell them to leak. That's when they disseminate propaganda to the public, like they did during the Trump years when they leaked the transcript between Michael Flynn and Ambassador Kislyak, the most serious kind of leaking crime. The Washington Post did that. Nobody looked for that leaker. Nobody cared. Everybody cheered because it served the interests of the security state. But when it comes to transparency that undermines the agenda of these agencies and that proves to the American people what the truth is, it's amazing that these journalists are on the side of the government and will actually hunt down the leaker and demand that he be punished even more.
I just don't understand how any journalist could collaborate in hiding the fact that we're in a direct hot war with Russia. Maybe you support that, maybe you don't. But how could you hide something that significant, the most significant fact of our generation, from the public? How could you do that?
The only answer is that you don't actually have a journalistic mindset, that you far more identify with your job as working for the government than working for the American people. If you look at the history of the most important journalism stories, it's exactly insiders like Daniel Ellsberg sees that the government is lying to the American people about the war in Vietnam, saying we're winning when in reality, privately, they're saying we're losing. And he goes and he shows the American people the truth. Or Edward Snowden, who heard James Clapper falsely deny the NSA was spying on American people. He had the evidence in his hand and he risked his security to show the truth. Same things WikiLeaks did. This is what you celebrate in journalism. Our journalists, meaning the media corporations, hate this because they actually work for their government. That is their true allegiance.
You have to defend truth tellers. You cannot abet lying if you have an entire country based on lies. It just does not end well. You have to tell the truth, I think. You're certainly a living example of that. Glenn Greenwald, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tucker.
Next up is Greg Reese called in on American Journal. And every once in a while, you know, he'll get a burr under his blanket and he'll call in like this. But he's expressing real concern for these handheld devices that police can use to tap into other people's smartphones, I should say. So this is a really good, about 10 minutes long, that he's really concerned about what's going on. This is, listen close to this. This is interesting and very important message.
This Palantir technology that this guy is telling me about, and it's not brand new. He's talking about using this for, you know, 10 years ago, is in the hands of pretty much every cop on the street. And so these devices, these handheld devices that can literally fit on a utility belt of a cop, can not only read your text, but they can read the entire contents of your phone. They just use it for texting because it's the most easy, obvious way of using it for their purposes. But it can actually, from what I was told by this lieutenant colonel, retired, is that they can just instantly read your entire phone.
Welcome back to the American Journal, folks. More great calls this segment. An honor and a pleasure to be with you this morning. You know, I was hosting the show as a guest a couple of months ago now, and the great Greg Reese called in. And ever since then, every time I come back on the show, I try to say something that will provoke him to call in again. And I think this morning we have hit the nail on the head. I'd like to hear from Greg. Greg, how are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you doing, Chase?
I'm doing good, man. It's good to hear from you again. I recently signed up for your email list after we did our podcast together, and I've really been enjoying your updates, man. I highly recommend that anybody sign up for them.
Oh, cool. Thank you. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Well, what provoked me was you were talking about the mysterious technology that was able to just read his text messages and his phone and everything like that. And the only reason I haven't done a report on this yet is because it's anecdotal. This is a story that was told to me by a retired combat pilot. You can Google what I'm about to tell you, and you'll find a lot of mainstream articles that are telling you most of this. But the depths of the technology, I have yet to find anything substantial where I could do a video on it. But here's what this gentleman told me. He ran a lot of missions in the Middle East, and they had a technology called Palantir, P-A-L-A-N-T-I-R, Palantir, a handheld device that they could literally just scan the surface of the earth with as they flew across in a jet and look for characters. They could read people's phones as they could program the Palantir to look for specific phone numbers and just scan people's mobile devices and fish for people. And then when they'd find someone, they would swoop down, grab them, throw them in a cell, and every day they'd say, who have you been talking to? And the guy would say, nobody. Or they'd say, have you been calling, you know, Bob Smith or whatever? And he'd say, no. And then they'd leave him in there, come back the next day, ask him again, leave him in there. And they just let him keep lying and lying and lying until he got tired. And then they'd finally come in, show him the Palantir device, and be like, you've been lying to us this whole time. We see here, we saw right away when we picked you up that you've been talking to this guy every day, blah, 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 blah. And then he explained to me the psychology behind it. You know, they let him keep lying and the whole, just to wear him down, make him tired. So when they finally gave him the reveal, he would feel a little desperate. But anyways, this Palantir technology that this guy is telling me about, and it's not brand new. He's talking about using this for, you know, 10 years ago. Is in the hands of pretty much every cop on the street. Cops have it so they can tell if you're texting while driving. I'm sure some people have stories of being pulled over by a cop, and the cop says, were you texting? And they said, no. And the cop's like, you're lying. I have you right here. You're texting. And so these devices, these handheld devices that can literally fit on a utility belt of a cop, can not only read your text, but they can read the entire contents of your phone. They just use it for texting because it's the most easy, obvious way of using it for their purposes. But it can actually, from what I was told by this lieutenant colonel, retired, is that they can just instantly read your entire phone. When I heard this, I was like, I'm not surprised, but what I'm surprised by is that you don't hear more about this. Like I said, if you Google Palantir police, you'll find lots of mainstream articles talking about how the cops have been quietly using it and stuff like that, but there is no secrecy anymore. That's a myth.
What really alarms me about this, Greg, is thinking about it in the context of the social credit score. So I think about the poor citizens that live in China, like under the CCP, where they actually have a formal social credit score. And with this technology, you can't even research controversial information on your own device. I mean, here at InfoWars, obviously, we try to push the truth any way that we can, despite the fact that the media is lying to the people. And at least in this country, we still at least have the freedom, regardless of whether we have the privacy or not, to do independent research and find controversial sources in order to try to determine what's true and what isn't. But with this technology, if it was linked up with a social credit score, I mean, they could harm you just because of the stuff that you search for, right?
Well, yeah, and from what I understood from this conversation, they were able to scan phones from high above, and once they would lock onto a number, they could access the contents, and they didn't even have to be in proximity. Once they had the person's mobile number, they could go home on the other side of the world and log on and continue to track that person. So we're all being tracked. We're all obviously hooked up to some AI supercomputer already.
Right.
Everything that we're saying is obviously already being monitored. We're obviously already listed off into our different little gangs and camps and tribes that we all identify with. So at this point, and then I think you were talking earlier about how the technology we know of is 30 years
Right.
You know, all that. I mean, so to be realistic about it, the threat you're talking about, it's already in place. Right now, we're just being acclimated to it and slowly drawn through the gates into this new brave new world.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, my buddy that I was talking about earlier that's in the cybersecurity industry with the secret clearance, he told me that the issue isn't – the challenge for the government isn't whether or not they can capture all the information, but it's how to sort of sift through it and analyze it, right? So our text messages, our search history, our phone calls, they're capturing all of that, but there isn't enough – of a workforce to manually audit everything and listen to everything. So they rely on technology, artificial intelligence to sift through and sort of pick up keywords. And then if something's flagged, then a human being may go in and look at it. But with artificial intelligence developing as quickly as it is, it seems to me that the informatics aspect of this, informatics simply being how to get useful information out of a bunch of data, with artificial intelligence developing, they're really going to be able to spy on you without a human being having to do it. I mean, the AI could actually be listening to you with the same efficacy as if a human being were listening to your every word.
I'm sure it already is. Mm-hmm. And just how they were able to get us all to eagerly sign up on social media and save them the trouble of having to track all of our information. We all were easily lured into volunteering to do that for ourselves. The same is happening right now with AI, with all these different I've tried a few. I had a conversation with AI that was very interesting. I did a free trial for the art where you can make it create art, yeah. And it's extremely fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I can easily see that they're going to now start having people just sign up on these things for free and create a relationship with AI, you know?
Yeah.
I heard Kathy O'Brien, the whistleblower back in the 90s, she claimed that AI was running everything back then, that DARPA and AI was at the seat of power, at the throne of power. And AI created the extraterrestrial story as a smokescreen cover for AI.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Greg. I do really appreciate that. It's always an honor and a pleasure to speak with you. We're about ready to go to a break now, but make sure you check out InfoWarsStore.com and stick with us because I want to touch on everything that Greg said in the next segment, too.
Coming up is Jim Jordan speaking with Maria Martiromo, and they're talking about going in and having a meeting of their committee up in New York City. And they're going to look into the crime problem up there. As overseers of Congress, they're concerned with crime in the big city. And the DA is saying it's one of the safest cities to be in America. So, boy, that's quite a reach in it. But here we go with Jim Jordan and Maria Martiromo.
Crime and no punishment. Manhattan's DA under fire from Republicans for indicting President Trump while allowing violent criminals to go free in the city. The House Judiciary Committee will hold a hearing they say will, quote, examine how Bragg's pro-crime, anti-victim policies have led to an increase in violent crime and a dangerous community for New York City residents. While Bragg's office says, don't be fooled, the House GOP is coming to the safest big city in America for a political stunt. Joining me right now is House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jim Jordan. Mr. Chairman, great to see you. Thanks so much for being here.
Good to be with you.
So New York Congressman and former Trump impeachment lawyer Dan Goldman says that this hearing on Monday is a waste of taxpayer dollars to support Trump's legal defense. And you say?
I think the mom who lost a son who served our country and was killed there in New York, when people hear her testimony, they won't think it's some kind of stunt. We want to hear from the victims, the families, the people in Manhattan, the people in New York who've been impacted by this surge in crime that has happened because you have DAs who are more focused on coddling criminals than they are putting them behind bars and making sure families and individuals and communities and business owners are impacted by the surge in crime we have seen because of those policies. And that's what this hearing is about. And I think also, frankly, Maria, there'll be this decision Bragg has made to be political and go after his political opponent. versus what he should be doing, which is putting bad guys behind bars so they don't bring harm to the community.
Well, we've seen the numbers, and it is a scary situation in New York right now. I live there, and I'm wondering if the media is actually communicating this to the public. I saw your tweet this week. You said C-SPAN covered Democrat-run field hearings in the past, but so far have refused to cover Republican-run Judiciary Committee field hearings. Why? So do you think C-SPAN will cover your hearing on Monday?
I don't think so. They've indicated that what they've told us so far is they're not going to come, not going to cover. They didn't go to the border. When we went to the border 6 weeks ago, the Yuma section down in Arizona, they didn't cover that field hearing. We had some powerful witnesses who told us how bad that problem was. Same thing here. We're going to have, I think, some great witnesses. Three have confirmed. We're looking at some others who are going to talk about what I just described, this rampant increase in crime. And yet, while that's going on, what you have, Maria, is the DA in Manhattan is using federal tax dollars to indict a former president for no crime, and then when we want to investigate that, he takes us to court. So that's what he's focused on. And he takes us to court because we want to talk to someone who hasn't worked in his office for a year, but wrote a book solely on this subject about going after the former president. So that's what Alvin Bragg's up to. Meanwhile, he's not putting bad guys in behind bars who are impacting the community in such a negative way.
Yeah, and yet here we have the indictment of Trump. He had to go down, get arraigned. He did so. And now we're understanding that there are more lawsuits behind this to come against the former president. So is this a two-tiered system of application of law?
Yeah, it's a political system. It's based on politics. And I think the country sees that. When you look at what Alvin Bragg's doing, and again, the Alvin Bragg has said, oh, the House Judiciary Republicans they're interfering in our investigation. It's just the opposite. They're interfering in our constitutional duty to do oversight. They are interfering. This prosecution, this indictment of President Trump is interfering in the most important election we have, election for President of the United States. And Alvin Bragg changed his mind because initially he wasn't going to bring this indictment. Then he changes his mind. And what happened in between that flip-flop? President Trump announces he's running for president, and he's winning. He's leading in every single poll. And so Alvin Bragg decides he's going to go after the other party's leader in the election for president, and that's what he does.
Yeah.
And we one of the things we'd like to know, too, is, frankly, was the Biden White House or the Biden DOJ, were they consulting? Was there any kind of coordination between them and the DA's office there in Manhattan? I mean, we don't know, but there's people who've moved from the Biden White House, Mr. Colangelo, Biden Justice Department, who now work in District Attorney Bragg's office.
Uh-huh.
When he was at the DOJ, was focused on the Trump investigation. So we'd like to know those things, too. That's why we've asked some questions of Mr. Colangelo as well.
Well, can you subpoena Alvin Bragg? I mean, let's face it. We learned that there would be an indictment of Trump just a couple of days after your colleague, James Comer, got the bank records of the Biden family influence peddling. And now this week we learned of a whistleblower, an Obama stenographer, says that Joe Biden, when he was vice president, knew well aware all about Hunter Biden's business deals, that this man was there, saw it happening on Air Force Two, saw it, emails showing Hunter's now defunct investment firm, Rosemont Seneca Partners, sought deals with the Irish government. They wanted investments in Ireland during his father's vice presidency. And sure enough, this week, Joe Biden goes to Ireland and he takes son Hunter on Air Force One.
Yeah, I know Chairman Comer is looking into this situation, and the real focus has been thus far the suspicious activity reports that we have seen. Of course, we saw the one where there was like $3 million given to Robinson Walker, and that was distributed out to various members of the Biden family. And I think the fundamental question we always ask, Marie, is, you know, what service did they provide? What did they get paid for?
That's right.
What was the value added that they gave? We don't know, but they were just getting paid this money. And so there's a reason they call them suspicious activity reports, these banking records that Treasury has. That they put together. That's where Mr. Comer's focused his investigation. And then, of course, we have this statement that recently came from the stenographer. We'll have to see.
Yeah.
But as far as our investigation with the district attorney there in Manhattan, everything's on the table. We started with Mr. Pomerantz because he hasn't worked there for over a year. And he went out and wrote a book on this subject, solely on this subject, about going after the former president. And we feel like if you're going to write a book and you're going to be the catalyst for helping convince the left to pressure Alvin Bragg to do this, which is what we think happened, We think you should answer our questions, and that's why we've subpoenaed him and want to talk to him. But, of course, Mr. Bragg has sued us, taking us to court. We will file our brief on Monday. The arguments will be made on next Wednesday, and we'll see what happens. But everything is on the table because we think we owe it to the American people. When you have a district attorney interfering in the most important federal election we have, and he used federal tax dollars as part of his indictment of president of the former president, then we think it's incumbent upon us to do the investigation. That's what we're committed to doing.
Well, you've said it before. Stop interfering in elections, DOJ, FBI. We're going to be watching your hearing, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Here we go next with Naomi Wolf, and she spoke recently at Hilldale College up in the Detroit area, and she spoke eloquently about what was in the Pfizer shots, talking about the vaccine and what was, how it's impacting young women, young fertile women that are trying to conceive, maybe sometimes for their first or second even child, and some of the problems that they've been encountering. So here we go with Naomi Wolf.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for that lovely introduction. Thank you everyone for being here. You're very brave, given what I'm going to share with you tonight. But I promise we'll go to a very dark and scary place, and then we'll come out into a place of hope and forward thinking. Yes, but I do admire your courage. And before I begin, I just want to find the words to express how grateful I am to Hillsdale College, not only for inviting me, but for being what it is, which is truly a light right now to not just America, but to probably the world in helping us remember what liberal arts are supposed to do and what Western civilization is supposed to be for and what it means to actually take on that incredibly powerful and responsible and sacred task of overseeing the education of young adults from the ages of 17 or 18 to 21 or 22. And out of all the institutions that I've witnessed in the last 3 years, this is the only one in which the students have not been traumatized. I'm so grateful to all of you. So I'm just going to jump right in. I'm a pacer. Is there a handheld mic I might use while I pace? And oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Bell. I'll stand here till a handheld manifests. So I should also start out by disclosing that I did spend my entire career on the left. I was an advisor to Gore 2000 and to the Clinton reelection. I'm sorry. I just feel I should share. I should share this. I should get it out. I should just be transparent. And the last 3 years have shown me that my former world has truly imploded and that now, yeah. Sad but true. But the happy part is that now I think something's happening in this country in which left and right really are losing any meaning. And what really matters is what I've found, which is my brothers and sisters are right here in this room. My brothers and sisters are anyone who cares about the Constitution, liberty, and freedom. So I'm so happy to be with you tonight. And I should also disclose, in case you're worried, this is not a pharma hit. I ran after a puppy. We have an adorable new puppy, and he was faster than I am. So that's that. All right. So I'm going to talk to you about what's really in the Pfizer documents. And if I pace around like this, can you hear me?
No.
All right. Okay. And the reason I know what's in the Pfizer documents is not because I'm a medical doctor. I'm not. It's not because I'm a scientist. I'm not. I'm an English major. My DPhil is in Victorian poetry. But I know what's in the Pfizer documents because something kind of miraculous in the history of intellectual inquiry happened to me and to the world as a result. And it's the following. some of you may know that a lawyer named Aaron Seary pursued a lawsuit against the FDA to release the internal documents that Pfizer created as part of its rollout of its mRNA injection. And these are internal documents showing what happened when people were injected with this material and also the experiments that led up to it internally. And thank God for the judge in that lawsuit, because the FDA asked that judge to keep these documents hidden for 75 years, right? Until long after we are all gone. Exactly. And the judge said no. And so the documents were released. So I read this. Thank you so much. And as a journalist, I was concerned because I knew that journalists – thank you so, so much. Are not equipped to, as lay people, to understand the technical language in the documents. And I also knew that Pfizer was releasing 55,000 documents a month, and even that is a bit deceptive because these are documents that each of them can be 10,000 pages long, right? So massive, a massive tranche of data, and that ordinary journalists, it was going to go into the memory hole unless we found specialized readers to read through, analyze, and interpret, and boil down into manageable reports, thank you so much, what was in the Pfizer documents. So I went on War Room, which is another great irony of this moment. Are we good? Good. Thank you so much. All right, thank you to this lovely lady who helped me be audible. Thank you. Thank you. I feel free here at Hillsdale. I can go anywhere. I can say anything. I went on War Room, which is, you know, one of these great ironies of this moment that Steve Bannon and I have this, you know, interlocutory platform where he listens to what I have to say, which is a miracle because I got deplatformed a year and a half ago for doing what I've done for 35 years, which is reporting on women's reproductive and sexual health. In June of 2021, I reported on the fact that women were experiencing menstrual symptoms subsequent to receiving an mRNA injection. I'm a feminist. I've been a feminist forever. My first book was published when I was 26. And it is not unusual for me to call attention to symptoms that women are having that are red flags. Anyone who knows eighth grade biology can tell if women are having menstrual symptoms, there are going to be other bad things happening down the road. And sure enough, Twitter deplatformed me for this obvious observation, and I was also smeared globally, and it turns out another lawsuit subsequently found that it was the White House, the CDC, possibly DHS, and Twitter all unlawfully colluding to deplatform and smear me for making this observation about women's health. Yeah, but fast forward, I was talking on War Room about the release of these documents, and I called for experts to help us read through them, and miraculously, 2,500 experts responded to this call. Right? Yes. Yes. But the story is not over because I was ill-equipped to manage them. And so we had physicians, we had RNs, we had biostatisticians, medical fraud investigators, lab clinicians, research scientists, cardiologists, pathologists, anesthesiologists, some of the most distinguished scientists and medical people imaginable. But it's virtually impossible to manage 2,500 experts around the world, especially, you know, if you don't have this background, wading through 55,000 documents a month. So again, the reason I tell this story is I really feel like something metaphysically beautiful is happening, even in the middle of something metaphysically hideous. And that is this tiny woman, Amy Kelly, this tiny doll-like woman, and I stress her tiny doll-like appearance because it's so stereotypical, but she's such a force of nature, right, belying those stereotypes. She offered to be our project manager. She stepped right in, and she just calmed the storm. And she organized these 2,500 experts, immediately 3,500 experts around the world, into six working groups with a committee at the head of each, who were busy churning out reports based on these primary source documents so that they could tell the world, using the highest level of analysis possible, but broken down into language that everyone could understand, what was in the Pfizer documents. So this is just stunning to me that this happened. So now there are 58 reports, and now is the sad part of what I have to tell you. The Pfizer documents contain evidence of the greatest crime against humanity in the history of our species. And I'm so sorry to have to walk you through this, but there's no way around it. We just have to go through. And the beauty of Hillsdale is that you all are tough and like truth. And so with truth, we can prevail. But it's painful. Some of the things that came to light, just some headlines. Pfizer knew, for instance, 1 month after rollout, so that's November of 2020, that the vaccines didn't work to stop COVID. Indeed, in the Pfizer documents, a month after rollout, and this is marketing, post-marketing, so it's out there, the spokesmodels are telling you to do it, the ads are in social media, you know, the ads are on television. A month after rollout, Pfizer's internal documents identify that the vaccines have vaccine failure and failure of efficacy, and they identify that the third most common side effect of the Pfizer vaccine is COVID. The second headline, which is stunning, is that within a month or two, Pfizer was getting so many reports of adverse events, meaning bad things happening to people who had been injected, that they understood that they needed to hire 2,400 full-time staffers in order simply to process the paperwork of the adverse events that they were receiving reports of, as well as to prepare for the flood of adverse events that they knew they would get in the near future. Pfizer knew in May of 2021 that the vaccines had caused heart damage in 35 minors within a week after the injection. And yet, and Pfizer knew, right? You've got to understand that all of these documents say FDA confidential at the bottom of them, right? Pfizer and the FDA shared these documents. And the FDA knew that 35 minors sustained heart damage. But the government of the United States, and I'm embarrassed to say I voted for these people, didn't tell parents until August of 2021 that there was an elevated risk of heart damage in healthy young adults. 4 months later, and in those 4 months, what did the young adults of America receive? A constant battering with propaganda on social media, on television, in news outlets, bought up by money in the CARES Act, as well as from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, with like influencers showing off their injection site, saying, you know, we can do this together, we can be strong, do it for grandma, all of this aimed at young adults. They did not tell the young adults, the healthy young adults of the United States, your generation, that this was elevating a risk of heart damage till 4 months later. You may recall that the CDC said that the materials of the injection stay in the injection site. And the materials are lipid nanoparticles. They are mRNA. And the lipid nanoparticles are an industrial fat, which is covered in polyethylene glycol, which is a petroleum byproduct, right? And spike protein. Well, the CDC said it stays in the injection site. And then it says, and I remember asking doctors, like, relatives who are doctors and were funded by NIH grants, where does the spike protein go?
And they were like, you know, when you're a journalist, you've got an ear for nonsense. They were like, well, your body metabolizes it, you know, or, well, you'll digest it and excrete it. And it's like they had no evidence to give me to show me the basis for their response. But in fact, that's not what happens to these materials. And Pfizer knew that. These materials biodistribute, this is Pfizer's language, throughout your body in 48 hours. And where do they settle? Well, lipid nanoparticles are designed to cross every membrane in the human body. They've known this for 10 years. So where do these ingredients go? They go to the brain. Some of you have noticed changes in the personalities of loved ones who have taken these injections. They biodistribute to the liver, the adrenals, the spleen, and if you're a woman, they accumulate in your ovaries. Now, these are industrial fats coated with polyethylene glycol in your ovaries, okay? And what's really scary, Dr. Robert Chandler, who's a respected pathologist who's treated the Lakers and the Angels, he wrote this report, and he shows that the chart shows the graph going down as it leaves the injection site, but going up as it accumulates in these various organs over time. And what's incredibly scary if you're a woman is that there's no mechanism that we've found by which the body gets rid of the lipid nanoparticles in the ovaries. So your first injection, some go into your ovaries. Your second injection, more go into your ovaries. Your booster, more go into your ovaries. There's no mechanism with which the body can release this material that we've seen.
We're following this with a speech given at Hillsdale, same place, but by Robert Kennedy Jr. And boy, did he lay it on and really hit it hard about what this vaccine and all these shots and viruses are all about. Here we go with Robert Kennedy Jr.
Thank you. I'm very, very happy to be here. Can you hear me? If you can't hear me, raise your hand. I'm really happy to be here. Although I've never been here before, it feels like almost like a homecoming because of the incredible role that this institution played during COVID-19, where it was the only college left in the country that really stood up for freedom. And, you know, when this college was established in 1844, abolitionists were despised by the vast majority, 90% of the people in our country hated them and thought they were crazy and that they, that they were unrealistic. And it wasn't really until 3 years into the Civil War that it flipped. And that, you know, the president came out and freed the slaves, and he couldn't do it because of the public antipathy for abolitionism. So it's really this institution has an extraordinary history, and it's been very, very faithful to the values upon which it was established, which is this love of freedom, no matter what public opinion, no matter what the public cost, no matter who pressures you to stop, but to stand up for it. And it's really a testimony to something special. And the investment that has been made here, not in building a pile, teaching students to build a pile for themselves like most colleges, and whoever dies with the most stuff wins, but instead building character. And demonstrating character. And, oh, thank you. I'm going to. Somebody last night asked me about how I got into the, you know, the anti-vax racket, and which I'm not anti-vaccine, although I'm kind of the poster child for the anti-vax movement. But I've been an environmental attorney for now 40 years. Up until 2005, that's all I did. And then that year, I ran a group called Hudson River Keeper, which I represented for 40 years, commercial fishermen on the Hudson and recreational fishermen, suing polluters who were destroying their livelihoods, their property values, their communities. And they had a business model. We have the oldest commercial fishery in the country on the Hudson. The people I represented for 40 years, many of them came from families that have been fishing the river continuously since Dutch colonial times. It's a traditional gear fishery. They use the same fishing methods that were taught by the Algonquin Indians, the original Dutch settlers of New Amsterdam, and then passed down through the generations. And they had a business model that worked for three centuries. And then they were put out of business by polluters who had political clout and who were able to manipulate government agencies, capture and manipulate government agencies in order to escape the discipline of the free market and force the public to pay their production costs. And they had turned the Hudson Valley into kind of a not free market capitalism, but corporate crony capitalism. And this corporate kleptocracy, which really is about socialism for the rich and a very savage and brutal and merciless brand of capitalism for the poor. And they saw this happening. And, you know, I fought for them for 40 years, but in 2000, we were successful. I brought over 300 successful lawsuits on the Hudson by the year 2000. We had forced polluters to spend $3.5 billion remediating the river. The river, when I started working there, caught fire. It turned colors depending on what color. They were painting the trucks at the GM plant in Tarrytown. It was dead water, zero dissolved oxygen for 20 miles north of the city, 20 miles south. Today it is an international model for ecosystem protection. It's the richest waterway in the North Atlantic. It produces more pounds of fish per acre, more biomass per gallon than any other waterway in the Atlantic Ocean north of the equator. It's the last major river system left in Atlantic that still has strong spawning stocks of all of its historical species of migratory fish. And the miraculous resurrection of the Hudson inspired river keepers on waterways all over the world. We became the biggest water protection group in the world. We have 350 water keepers. Each one has a patrol boat. They each patrol a local waterway, and they litigate against polluters. And we're a law enforcement organization. We have great environmental laws, but because of agency capture, they're almost never enforced. And so, but we're allowed to enforce them under, you know, a provision called the citizen supervision. In 2003, the National Academy of Sciences published a report that showed that every freshwater fish in North America, 10-year study, was contaminated with dangerous levels of mercury. And so the water keepers who represent fishermen were particularly, this seemed to us like we were living in a science fiction nightmare, where my children, the children of every other American, could now no longer engage in the seminal primal activity of American youth, which is to go fishing in the local waterway and then come home and safely eat the fish. And those companies had privatized the public commons, a resource that is owned by the public, to make profits for themselves. They had privatized. We no longer own the fish. You know, the companies who are doing that polluter, which is coal-burning power plants and cement kilns primarily. So in 2005, we started suing. A lot of people were suing coal plants, but we were suing them. The water keepers were suing them on mercury. And I had 40 suits going by 2005. And I was traveling all around the country talking to crowds like this about mercury. And at almost every speech I gave, these groups of women, and they were different at every place, would come and sit in the front row before long. They'd show up early, and then when I finished, they'd wait and they'd ask to talk to me. And as it turns out, they were all of them with the mothers of intellectually disabled children. And they all believed that the vaccines had caused their child's injury, particularly mercury vaccines. And they would say to me in a very respectful but also kind of vaguely scolding way, if you're really interested in mercury exposures to children, you need to look at vaccines. I didn't want to do it. I had spent a lot of my life working on the issues of intellectual disabilities. I was raised, was part of the DNA of my family. My Aunt Eunice was also my godmother, started Special Olympics. I had been working at, well, in Special Olympics, was then called Camp Shriver, since I was 8 years old. Every weekend as a hugger, as a coach, I spent 200 hours as a teenager in high school working in Wasaic Home for the Retarded. My family, my uncle was chair of the health committee for 50 years. My family wrote a lot of the legislation that gave rights and changed the entire relationship with individuals with intellectual disabilities, the most vulnerable population in the country. But I didn't want to do that for my life. I wanted to work on fisheries, on water pollution, on energy. And so I was dodging these ladies. And then one of them came to my house, found my house on Cape Cod in the summer of 2005. She was a psychologist from Minnesota named Sarah Bridges. She had a son who got severe autism from a mercury vaccine. He had gotten a $20 million award from the vaccine court, which recognized his autism came from the vaccine. There was no controversy, and she didn't want it to have another children. And she showed up at my house, and she took out of the trunk of her car a stack of studies about 18 inches deep. She put it on my front stoop, and she knocked on the door. And when I came to the door, she pointed to the pile, and she said, "I'm not leaving here till you read those." And I'm accustomed to reading science. I wanted to be a scientist when I was a kid. And the kind of law that I practice involves a lot of science. So almost every suit that I brought has involved some kind of scientific controversy. And I would not be very good at my job if I didn't enjoy reading science and if I could not read it critically. And so I sat down. I didn't read the studies, but I read the abstracts. And I got about 6 inches down on that pile, and I was just dumbstruck by this huge delta between what the public health agencies were saying the science said and what the actual peer-reviewed published science was saying. And I started after that doing what I always did when I didn't understand something. I had, because of my name and my family's relationships with these agencies, I could always get the head of an agency on a phone very quickly. And I started calling them and asking questions. I got Francis Collins from NIH and Kathleen Stratton and Marie McCormick from Institute of Medicine. And they told me something weird. I asked them about the science, and I realized they were completely not conversant with it. They were just parroting this phrase, safe and effective. They hadn't read any of the actual science. And when I asked them about details, they said, "You have to talk to Paul Offit." Well, Paul Offit is a vaccine developer who's a partner of Merck's. And, you know, I had been working with EPA for many years, suing about probably 20% of my lawsuits were against EPA, which is a captive agency, but captive by the oil and chemical and pesticide industries. And, you know, EPA, if I call a science guy or a regulator there, they're going to have some self-respect. And they're going to try to answer my question. They're not going to direct me to a coal industry lobbyist. So this was bizarre. And then when I talked to Paul Offit, I caught him in a lie. Which I'm not going to go into. I'd love to go into, but I'm going to. I need to conserve my time here, so take my word for it. And but he knew I caught him in the lie. I knew, and there was that moment where we're like, you are just a liar. And so then I realized, okay, these guys either don't know what they're doing or they're lying about it deliberately. And then I realized these agencies were completely captured, but agency captured on steroids. FDA gets more than 50% of its budget from the pharmaceutical companies. CDC has a $12 billion budget, and $5 billion of that, so almost half, goes to buying vaccines from these companies and then distribute them. So if you work at CDC, you do not get promotions by finding problems with vaccines. You get promoted by increasing uptake. And then NIH is just an incubator for pharmaceutical products. So it develops the vaccines, hands them over to the industry, hands them over to the universities, which then get NIH money, $200, $300 million to do phase two and phase three, phase one and phase two trials. Then if those are successful, which they always are because they make them successful, they then call in the pharmaceutical company to do a phase three, and then they all divide up the royalty, the patent margin rights, and then they all go, you know, then Tony Fauci, who's the head of NIH, walks it through the regulatory process at FDA and CDC, where he's picked the members of the panels who are all taking money from him. And they know their product is next in line, and their job is to rubber stamp this product and recommend it to children. So I saw this process and how it worked. And it's beyond, you know, it was regulatory capture on steroids. It was like, and then NIH gets the money. I got the platform for saying NIH owns half of this the Moderna vaccine. They said that's vaccine misinformation. Well, guess what? On Thursday this week, Moderna made a $400 million payment to NIH for its share of the royalties to date. So, you know, all of my conspiracy theories have about a three-month shelf life before they become reality.
Thank you for listening this evening. I'm going to put up a lapel. Stacy Lapel was one of the teachers that grazed one of the shots, grazed her arm, but she was able to get most of her classroom into the room and save most of them. During the Parkland Douglas High School shooting. And so she's quite a hero, and we must really respect her. But she said some very unusual things about the shooter. She said that she actually watched the shooter fire down the hallway, and she said at first that it seemed like the police were there. But she said they were in combat gear and so forth, and firing down the hallway, and then they finally shot towards her and killed one of her teachers, I think, next door to her room. So I'm going to put that up, and also going to put up some video of what was going on immediately after that, after it had settled down. There seemed to be some kind of a team or, you know, leaving the other end of the building, the other end from where the security guard was. And so it's sort of very suspicious, and we need to look into this more and see what was really going on, because what she says and what really the press is putting out are two different things. But anyway, thank you for listening, and good night. God bless.